Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Welcome to the first panel on Saturday morning for the Comics and Popular Arts Conference here at Dragon Con. We'll go ahead and we'll get started with Wonder Woman and Greek Mythology here with our presenters, Matt Brown and Dan Amerine, just a second. But before we do, I want to go ahead and tell you a little bit about us here at CPAC, for those of you who are unfamiliar. We are a group of academics who get together every year, and we talk with all of you about interesting issues within comics, horror, film, TV, the general fandoms that are the reason that we are here at Dragon Con every year. And we do so from, you know, bringing an academic perspective to a lot of these ideas and a lot of these issues to try and get a sense for how they would work and intersect with a professional and academic capacity. So a lot of what we do can be found online at the links and Twitter handles and Facebook pages that you see up there. You can also find some of our audiovisuals from past years if you've not experienced this, if this will be your first time. You can also get a sense for the other kinds of things that we'll be doing. We've passed out a few programs. We have some more up at the front for anybody who didn't get some. We have some more up here at the front in case you missed that somehow. This is going to be our 8th annual show, and we are actually extraordinarily pleased to see a full standing room only panel across from the parade. Like, that's... Thank you. Thank you so much. Like, that is amazing. And we couldn't do these kinds of things without your interest, without your help. So thank you all for being here. We really appreciate it. If you would like to get involved, you can keep an eye out for our call for papers and our call for abstracts. That'll be coming up pretty soon on the heels of this year's con. So if you just go to thehangman.com/CPAC, you'll be able to find information about us and more contact information for all of us. So just thank you all once again. And let's go ahead and get started. I'll introduce... First up, we have a change in the schedule presentation real quick. Yes, we're going to do Matt Brown and his paper, Love and Strife, Aphrodite and Ares, Marston's Manichaean Reconfiguration of Greek Mythology, and Philosophy in the Wonder Woman Comics. Matt Brown's from UT Dallas. Give him a hand, everybody.
Okay. The title was really long. It didn't fit on the slide, so a little shorter up here. So I'm going to focus on the original 1940s Wonder Woman comics by William Moulton Marston. And I think if I understand correctly, Dan is going to give us a kind of broader view of the relationship between Wonder Woman and Greek mythology. We all know, right, the Greek pantheon. We learned this in school. Zeus, Hera, Apollo, Ares, Aphrodite, and so on. A big group, right? Shown here on a classic piece of Greek sculpture or architecture. And traditionally, the pantheon is depicted in a kind of hierarchical fashion, right? Zeus at the top, in the chair there on the right. Everybody else kind of looks to him. Poseidon and Hades have pretty high positions as well, and there's a kind of hierarchy to it. And this is the Greek mythology we all learned. If you were to look back at the Wonder Woman comics of the 1940s, you would not recognize this kind of picture. Right? You'd see a very different, very strange version of some of the familiar Greek myths. So I'm going to go through some examples from that. So here, from one of the tellings of Wonder Woman's origin story, I didn't write sources down on my notes here, but I believe this is from Wonder Woman number one. Ares and Aphrodite are depicted in front of a globe showing Europe and Asia Minor. The text says, "The planet Earth begins, the ancient script, is ruled by rival gods, Ares, god of war, and Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty. Ares says, my men shall rule with the sword. And Aphrodite says, my women shall conquer men with love." In a later In a later comic, we see Ares and Aphrodite at it again, right? So here Mars, the god of war, taunts Aphrodite. Ho, ho, the whole world's at war. I rule the earth, right? And Aphrodite, patriot that she is, says, your rule will end when America wins, and America will win. I'll send an Amazon to help her, right? So what's going on that is leading Ares to think he's winning? World War II, right? The whole world is at war, practically. Here's a long... Marston liked to write in a way that wasn't always so compatible with the format of comics, so you occasionally get these long text walls in his comics, but I'm going to read you some excerpts from this long text wall to give you a sense of how he was thinking in more detail about these things. So he says, today the spirit of war rules supreme over the entire earth. Whence does it come? Why do human beings every generation or so since the beginning of history feel an uncomfortable urge to fight and kill one another? The ancient Greeks believed there was a god behind it, a mighty invisible god of war who urged human beings on to conquer their fellows and destroy every man and woman who resists. The Greeks were right about a lot of things. They made great discoveries in mathematics and astronomy. They founded modern science and modern medicine. This is a remarkable line. Scientists may yet prove that the Greek god of war exists. As I'll talk about in a minute, William Moulton Marston was himself a scientist, and I think this gives you a good sense of what kind of scientist he was. Ares, the Greeks called him, though we know him better by his Roman name of Mars. I don't know why we know that better, but okay. It is, I guess, because of the planet Mars. It is he who stirs up the spirit of war in the hearts of mankind and who seeks to rule this earth, as he rules it now, from his iron palace on the planet Mars, a world which he conquered and named for himself. Mars lives on Mars. Ares lives on Mars. Aphrodite doesn't seem to live on Venus, but she has a whole enclave of winged women there that we'll talk about. So Mars and Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty, have been rivals for control of this earth ever since life began. At present, Mars is far ahead in the struggle against his beautiful opponent. More than 4/5 of the entire world is at war. More than 2 billion people are involved in the present colossal conflict. Mars is triumphant. And then it goes on to introduce the conflict of the story, which is that Wonder Woman sort of set up as this agent of Aphrodite to help fight Mars by helping America win the war. Now Mars or Ares and Aphrodite come up over and over again to the point where the other Greek gods are almost entirely absent. You occasionally see Athena. You hear reference to Hera, but it's very rare you see reference in these 1940s comics to other Greek gods and goddesses. And when, for example, Ares needs people to help him out, right, instead of making use of the existing pantheon, we get Marston chose to create a bunch of new characters, like General Destruction, who is a general, and a pun. The Earl of Greed, the Lord of Conquest, and the Duke of Deception, which are some pretty gruesome-looking dudes. So Marston chooses to kind of create this alternative set of demigods to help out Ares instead of make use of any figures from existing mythology. So, right, instead of the familiar pantheon of gods and goddesses, we get a picture as if Ares and Aphrodite are the entire pantheon. There's rare reference to other gods and goddesses, as I said, but this is sort of the main thing. And the struggle between them is depicted in what I would call a Manichaean fashion, right? So Manichaeanism is a name for one of the sort of early heresies in the Christian church, right? And it's something that St. Augustine wrote against, but was originally very attracted to in his young sort of philosophical life. And the Manichaean heresy is the view that God and Satan are kind of equally powerful powers. They're equally strong powers, and their struggle over the universe is playing out. So that sort of faith in God, the Christian God, is taking side in a war, right, between two forces, one of evil and one of good. Here, Marston depicts Greek mythology, again, in a very Manichaean fashion. You have, instead of good and evil, you have war and love, right? Again, battling it out over the fate of the world. And the big guy, right, Zeus, in Marston's reconfiguration, is essentially absent. So what I want to talk about in the rest of my presentation are two things. One is a piece of Greek philosophy, ancient Greek philosophy, which bears a resemblance to Marston's view. And then I want to talk about Marston's own work as a scientist and how that relates to this idea of Ares and Aphrodite locked in a Manichaean struggle for humanity. So, the pre-Socratic philosopher Empedocles had an interesting view of how the world worked. Empedocles was impressed by arguments of some of the earlier Greek philosophers, particularly Parmenides and Heraclitus. Parmenides' argument was that fundamental substances can never change, right? That the idea that the base constituent of the world can change is nonsensical, is logically inconsistent. Through a long and complicated argument, he came to the view that the world basically was just this one single unchanging substance, and every appearance that there is time or change in the world is an illusion. Right? Empedocles liked the logical argument that fundamental substances can never change, but he didn't like dismissing everything that happened around him as a mere illusion, and so he tried to find a way out. This sort of opposite view from Parmenides is the view of Heraclitus, who thought that the only thing real was change. Everything was a kind of flux, right? Heraclitus's famous saying was, "You can never step into the same river twice," right? Because the second time you put your foot in, the current has washed everything that you could see downstream, and it's a totally different river in front of you. It's always everything is in this constant change, and stability is a kind of illusion or happenstance. Right? So Empedocles tried to put these two ideas together, he came up with a view of the world which is somewhat familiar. The idea that the world was governed by the movements and mixtures of four material elements. He called them roots. Earth, air, fire, and water, right? Classic Greek four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And their movements were governed, and these things never changed, right? So you have a bit of air, right? The air itself never changes. It's a fundamental substance, just like Parmenides says. But you get interesting changes when these substances interact or mix, right? Not unlike the modern chemical idea that you take atoms, which are not totally unchangeable but don't change very often, you put them together in different configurations and you get different molecules, different substances. So Empedocles had an idea like that. But in his mind, there were two fundamental forces or laws or archae that caused these movements and mixtures of the elements, and they were named love and strife. Right? Love is the force that brings things together. Strife is the thing that pulls things apart. And he had this idea that there was a cosmic cycle according to which at certain eras, love was dominant, right? And you had a pure harmony, a world he called the sphere, in which all elements were mixed together in a uniform mixture. You couldn't tell where any piece apart. And then you had, on the opposite end, the time when pure chaos rules, pure strife rules. He called that the whirl, like a whirl in the bathtub, I guess. And this was when things were sort of were separate and chaotic, right? And in both of these epochs, life is not possible. It's not possible for life to exist in a world of pure harmony or a world of pure chaos. And you would get the generation of life either when we were moving from chaos to harmony or vice versa. And he posited what in retrospect looks a little bit like an evolutionary view, right? That as things start to come together, you get, for example, like arms and legs kind of on their own, moving around. And then they join together in weird combinations like an ox-faced man or a man-faced ox. And certain of these combinations are more suited to survival than others. And eventually you'll get in these kind of these two periods in the middle fairly well-functioning organisms like we see in front of us. So Empedocles is one of the few kind of historical antecedents of this idea that we have, that we might have this metaphysical level battle between love and strife driving things. And Marston was a student of the classics, although not a very careful student, as you can see from the comic books. He may have been familiar with this idea, although I don't have evidence that he was. But this, I think, is an interesting connection. Perhaps even more interesting is the connection between Marston's psychological theories and his and the Wonder Woman pantheon. So I'll talk a bit about this. So many of you will know this. William Moulton Marston started out as an experimental psychologist. Started work in the late 19 teens. Worked steadily in that field until about 1930. He's best known historically as the inventor of the lie detector test, or at least an important component of the lie detector test based on blood pressure measurements. He used the same techniques, this is less well known, he used the same techniques that he used to build the lie detector to study all sorts of emotions and emotional response. And it was the study of emotions that really captured him. His most important work of psychology was his book, The Emotions of Normal People, a long work where he laid out his theory of emotions in detail, how the emotions work, where they come from, how they're constituted physiologically, and what it tells us about behavior, normal and abnormal, and society. The basic emotions, according to Marston, which he laid out on this kind of circular diagram, which he explicitly compared to the color wheel, the first psychologist, I think, to compare the emotional spectrum to the color wheel. The basic emotions, according to Marston, were not things like joy, fear, rage, kind of common sense emotional terms. He thought we needed better scientific terms, and the ones he posited in his theory were dominance, inducement, submission, and compliance, which are pretty weird names for emotions. The definition of these terms is kind of complex, and I won't get into it too much, but dominance and compliance form a pair, submission and inducement form a pair. Some emotions are more self-driven, right? They come more from the movement generated by the self. So dominance and inducement are more self-driven emotions. Some are more reactive or passive emotions driven by a stimulus. So compliance and submission are those kind of emotions. What's most interesting for our purposes is that these emotions combine into two complex emotional families, right? One are the sets of emotions based on dominance and compliance that he calls appetite. The other are the complexes of emotions based on inducement and submission that he calls love, right? And it's central to Marston's theory that appetite and love are the two types of emotional states that are most important and most in tension with one another, and that in order to achieve emotional health, one has to have a psyche, right, where your appetite emotions are configured or serving your love emotions. So love and appetite, love and strife, war and love. Incidentally, if those weird categories of emotions ring any bells, this system is in some way still in practice in management circles as the DISC personality typing system. The appetite emotions become task-oriented personality traits, and the love emotions become people-oriented personality traits. So as I said, what Marston termed the love emotions were supposed to be primary, and the appetite emotions had to be subservient to or adapted to the love emotions. This is a quote from that book, The Emotions of Normal People. So that's what constitutes a normal relationship, or normal was Marston's word for healthy relationship, healthy emotional relationship. In fact, he said nature intended the love elements to control self-gratification, which is appetite. It's the hope for future evolution that we learn to adapt appetite to love. He even said, love is the ultimate end of all activity. It's not just a philosophical claim, but it's a claim about psycho-emotional health. And lastly, Marston believed he had scientific evidence that showed that only women were capable of active love in sufficient quantity to be what he called love leaders, right? And if the person in your own psychological states, you have to be ruled by love, right? So too, society has to be ruled by love. This means that only women are capable of running society. As he combats the idea that women are the weaker sex, right? In fact, that's the exact opposite of the emotional situation. They are by far the more adequate for leadership, more qualified for leadership. And I'll end with this quote, which is Marston writing to one of the early historians of comics, Colton Law. He said, frankly, Wonder Woman is psychological propaganda for the new type of woman who should, I believe, rule the world. There isn't love enough in the male organism to run this planet peacefully. So ultimately, the story about Ares and Aphrodite is part of a campaign by Marston to show the way in which love, and through their capacity for love, women ought to rule human society. That would be the governing principles of human society. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matt. That was very good. Thank you. Next up, we've got Daniel Amrine with his paper, Wonder Woman and the Reappropriation of Women Warriors of Greek Myth. Hand for Daniel.
Amazing. All right. Hey, everyone. All right. So ancient Greek mythological representations of Amazons tend to teeter between the kind of noble, savage archetype and fetishized exotic prizes ripe for conquest by male heroes. So although these women are painted as powerful figures, they're not very empowering. So my presentation will explore ancient Greek depictions of the Amazon, as well as the patriarchal warrior deity Athena, and then I'll explore ways in which Marston and H.G. Peters, the creators of Wonder Woman, subverted and reappropriated these stories. All right. So here's kind of an overview of what we're going to talk about. I'm going to start by defining... Yeah, can you hear me? Okay, good, good. All right, so I'm going to start by defining reappropriation. Then we're going to look at the Scythians, who were real-life Amazons. We're going to look at depictions of Amazons in Greek art and myth, and then we're going to talk about how these ideas and depictions were subverted and reappropriated in Golden Age Wonder Woman. So let's go ahead and define reappropriation just so that we're all kind of on the same page moving forward. So Melinda Yen Chin Chen defines reappropriation as an array of theoretical and conventional interpretations of both linguistic and non-linguistic collective acts in which a derogatory sign or signifier is consciously employed by the original target of the derogation, often in a positive or oppositional sense. So what this means is that reappropriation is when an oppressed group consciously and intentionally changes the connotations of and or the context of a derogatory word, symbol, or idea, and then uses it in a subversive manner. So an example of this would be the term queer, right? Traditionally, this was used almost exclusively as a slur. More recently, however, it's come to be through actions of the LGBTQ community. Now it's kind of a neutral term. It's just an adjective. It's kind of lost most of that negative connotation. Another example would be the term bitch. While it's still negatively connotated, there are movements to try to turn that into a more positive word. So they're trying to change it from a negative connotated term to a positive. So you see things like boss bitch or bad bitch, or if you follow Kelly Sue DeConnick, bitches get shit done, right? So that's what reappropriation is. So I'm saying that the Wonder Woman comics of the 1940s did this with Amazons, okay? So this is also commonly referred to as kind of like taking it back, although I need to note that it doesn't actually have to be a symbol or term or idea that belonged to the oppressed group. However, in the case of the Amazons, it actually was. You see, the Amazons have traditionally, in modern day, thought to be pure myth. But thanks to recent archaeological discoveries, we now know that Amazons were at least inspired by real-life warrior women of the Scythian people. We've now identified over 300 graves of warrior women buried with weapons and oftentimes their horses. As was the custom of the Scythian warriors. So we found them in what was once ancient Scythia. Previously, all graves that contained weapons in archaeology were just thought to be men, by default, no question asked. But now with DNA testing and closer examination, we went, oops, sorry. Really, academics really, really dropped the ball on this one. There's a ton of evidence that clearly demonstrates that the Greeks acknowledged that the Amazons were a subgroup of Scythian. There are lots of Greek references to Amazons and their husbands, or Amazons and their Scythian allies, or the Scythians led by the Amazons. This is kind of a map of the Black Sea region where the Scythians actually ruled and controlled territory. So the red dots are Amazon strongholds in Greek myth and histories. The blue territory is where the Amazons lived in Greek mythology. It's all firmly in Scythia, okay? It's actually the little peninsula of Scythia that is closest to the Greeks, so it was the area of Scythia that the Greeks would have the most contact with people from, all right? Here's a kind of bigger overall area of an overview of this area. So this is the Black Sea, Caucasus, and Caspian Sea regions. You can see Greece down in the corner in kind of pink, just to kind of give you a scale of, you know, where we're talking here. Isocrates states that the three most aggressive races with hostile designs on Athens were the Persians, okay, which is, of course, located in modern-day Iran. We have the Thracians, who were an Indo-European tribe in southeastern Europe, and then the Scythians. Okay, so these are that northern Black Sea area and into, it's kind of like modern-day Ukraine. Okay, Amazons, real-life Amazons, the Scythians, did not remove their breasts. They did not hobble or otherwise injure male children or adults. and they did not hate men. One Greek historian actually stated that they were, quote, natural lovers of men. Although there were some clear depictions of lesbian Amazons in Greek art. Some of that might have been more for Greek men than for actual men.
Has been the case through history.
Exactly. So who were the Scythians, the real Amazons, okay? The Scythians were the Greek name for a loose collection of semi-nomadic tribes that dominated this area, okay? The Caucasus and Central Asian steppes. They were an egalitarian society wherein men and women performed the same tasks and roles within society. They both went to war, okay? They went to war in gender-segregated units, or war parties, and also together. There's actually evidence to suggest that both male and female Scythians weren't allowed to get married until they killed a man in battle. This ensured that everyone could fight. Once they killed a man in battle, they could continue killing men in battle, or they could settle down and then only kill men in battle when things got really bad. There's actually one grave of a warrior woman buried with her young child, so presumably there was a raid and she fought and died with weapons, you know, and then obviously things didn't go too good for her. There are many family units buried with weapons, and even children were buried with toy weapons. So you see small graves of boys and girls with little, basically like training bows and things. They also hunted together, they shared political power, they had female rulers and male rulers. Both men and women wore pants, which was very, very strange to the Greeks since everyone wore skirts. They also wore long sleeve tunics and felt or leather hats. The hat on the left is actually more accurate, the kind of David the Gnome looking thing. The hat on the right is a little too, that's a Persian hat. But this is probably one of the best depictions of, or pretty close approximation to, what the Amazons actually looked like. So they were also horse people. They had riding, their riding skills far surpassed the Greeks. They also had superior weapons. They had recurve bows 100 years before the Greeks. According to the Greeks, the Scythians actually made iron weapons well before them. Okay, so they were, from a war standpoint, kind of superior to the Greeks. They didn't build this, you know, they were semi-nomadic, so they didn't have the architecture and things like that, but they didn't need it. They were also tattooed, they smoked cannabis, and they drank fermented milk, so alcoholic milk, since the time they were infants. That was basically their formula. So the women could ride off to war, and then the men could give their baby boozy milk. So these were the people that were mythologized by the ancient Greeks as Amazon. They were an egalitarian society where men and women were actually equal. Okay, so let's look at how Greek popular culture depicted them. I mentioned before that there was kind of this savage noble archetype, right? To the Greeks, anyone that didn't speak Greek was a barbarian. And that was just a blanket term. In art, barbarians, quote-unquote, wore non-cultural specific clothing. So a barbarian, an outsider, would wear Persian, Scythian, Thracian clothes sometimes at the same time. That's why that one Amazon has a Persian hat on. They said, oh, those are those barbarians. They all dress the same, basically. Although as they became, over the centuries, as they became more knowledgeable of these cultures, they did start depicting them more accurately. So even though the Amazons were kind of lumped into all the other like barbarians, all the other quote-unquote savages, in some ways they were actually depicted better than the others. In Greek art, Persians are always shown running away from battle or dying. There's definitely a racist element there. The Scythians and the Amazons, which again to the Greeks there weren't much of a distinction except for gender, they're shown on equal footing as the Greeks. Amazons were worthy adversary to Greeks and Greek heroes within Greek art. So here you have... Here you have a scene of the nude Greek men fighting Amazons. So if you see clothes on them, they're an Amazon. You can again see here, some are dressed like Greek people, some are dressed like Thracians. Their clothes are all over the place. You can see the Greek man down at the bottom left has like a bunch of arrows in him. Like he's about to bite it. This is a really tense battle sequence. And they're shown on equal footing. The woman in the middle with her sword up like this, she's about to... That's a killing blow, but it's risky because it opens her entire midsection up. So that Greek, that battle right there, that's very, very tense. That could go either way. So this is kind of how they were depicted. They were depicted as noble because they were so strong, which, of course, is problematic, and it's more to uplift the Greeks for defeating them. But yeah, that's kind of how they fell into that noble savage archetype. They're also considered the daughters of Ares in Greek myth. Sometimes literal. Some of the Amazon queens are his literal daughter. Again, this is kind of to tie them into their warlike, you know, their nature. But we know that Scythians and Amazons did not follow the Greek pantheon. That was just, again, trying to impose their own culture onto them to understand them. So I mentioned that they're also kind of treated as fetishized objects to be tamed or won. Violence against Amazons was often sexualized in Greek art and storytelling, so that there's a strong symbolic and sometimes literal link between military and sexual conquest. Many of the depictions of Amazons are very erotically charged. In Greek art, Amazons' pants and sleeves were sometimes so tight that scholars are still unable to tell what's supposed to be clothing and what's supposed to be tattoos. They're also shown in action poses to show off their contours, right? So the Amazons are kind of like the Greek superheroines, where they use those action poses to kind of show off what the Greek male viewer wanted to see. While this might not seem very racy by today's standards, when you consider that Greek women of the time dressed like this, then you can kind of see why the ideas of contours of trousers and sleeves were so titillating to the Greek men. And then, of course, sometimes they abandoned all but the frailest of pretense and would show them bathing. These are some naked Amazons in the river. So we've talked about how they're depicted in art. Let's look at three of the kind of most famous Amazon queens in Greek myth, okay? So of course, first off the bat, we have Queen Hippolyta and Hercules. So this is Hercules' ninth labor. So Hercules is supposed to get Hippolyta's war belt. This is Ares' war belt given to her by Ares. So he shows up with his men. The Amazons come out and say, "Hey, how you doing?" And then they talk for a while and they negotiate peacefully. And Hippolyta says, "Yeah, sure, take my belt, no big deal." But because Hera is awful, Hera was like, "Oh, that's too easy, and I hate Hercules." So she disguised herself as an Amazon, ran around yelling, "Oh, they're abducting the queen!" And then the Amazon said, "Oh, let's kill them all." So then Hercules killed them all. So here we have a picture of Hercules taking Hippolyta's belt, okay? There's some sexual connotations with giving up your belt, your garment, your girdle, or taking it. Often these two are also depicted as lovers in Greek art. So again, there's that strong link between military and sexual conquest. The next queen I want to talk about is Queen Antiope, and then the story of her and Theseus, right? So Theseus, in some stories, is part of Hercules' exhibition to the Amazon stronghold. And after Theseus beats her in battle, Hercules says, "Hey, good job, you can have her now," and literally offers her up as a prize for her courage in war. In other versions, Theseus leads his own exhibition, without Hercules, and then just tricks her or takes her herself, or himself, and just steals her. Sometimes he says, "Hey, check out my boat," and then drives away. So there again, there's this very strong link between military and sexual conquest. The last queen I want to talk about quickly is Queen Penthesilea and Achilles. So this takes place during the Trojan War, which was an incredibly misogynistic war fought by the Greeks in Greek myth. The Amazons were led by their queen, Penthesilea, and sided with Troy against the Greeks, okay? So Athena's with the Greeks. The Amazons and Ares are with Troy, okay? So these two titans ride out to battle backed by their various patron gods, and Achilles kills the queen of the Amazons. He then removes her helmet and immediately falls in love with her beautiful dead corpse. Previously, Achilles, when he killed someone, would strip them down and like ride them behind his chariot. He's so overcome with her beauty and her courage that he doesn't do that. He actually returns her body and the bodies of all of her Amazons to the Trojans so that they can bury them respectfully. When Achilles takes off her helmet, all the other men gather around and all wish that they had wives like the Amazons back home waiting for them in Greece. There's such a weird fascination to see these two together that there was later in antiquity a story arose that they were lovers before this and had previously had a child together. So people wanted these two, this dead woman and this hero, to consummate so much that they said, "Oh, it already happened."
They shifted hard.
So, of course, we can't talk about Greek attitudes towards warrior women without mentioning Athena. Athena was the virgin goddess of war and wisdom. She's a very patriarchal deity. She's a motherless deity who sprung fully formed from Zeus's head. She is quite literally the patriarch's idea of what a dutiful and sexually chaste daughter should be. She's exclusively the patron of male heroes. Again, powerful but not empowering. I want to talk about a couple stories for her real quick, and then we'll get to Wonder Woman, I promise. The Medusa myth. So Medusa is raped by Poseidon in Athena's temple. Athena doesn't like that, so Athena turns the rape victim into a literal monster that no man can look at. She then decides that that's not good enough for the rape victim. So then Athena tells a male hero, "Go cut off her head and bring it to me." So he does, and then Athena says, "Now I'm going to wear this severed head on my shield or breastplate, depending on the story, as a trophy." Not very friendly towards women, guys. Probably the most telling story of Athena's kind of attitude towards women is the story of Orestes. Okay, so this is the family tree here. So Agamemnon is a commander of the Greek military at Troy. So he wants favorable weather conditions to travel. So he kills his daughter. Okay, sacrifices his daughter. Okay, like you do. Yeah, you know. I'm a Greek man. She's just a lady. Whatever. She belongs to me. So this doesn't sit well with his wife. Okay. Clytemnestra, when Agamemnon returns, kills him, both for the death of their daughter and because he raped her and forced her into marriage the first time. Okay, that's why they have children at all, is because he raped her. So their son, Orestes, doesn't like that she killed the patriarch, so he kills her. So he's the hero of the story. So, because of this, he's hounded by the Furies, who are the literal female incarnations of vengeance, okay? So they chase him around, tormenting him. So Athena doesn't like that but he's a guy. So she gives him shelter, kind of helps arrange a little trial for him, and then gets to cast the deciding vote to determine, is he guilty of a crime? And this is what Athena has to say about Orestes murdering his mother. No mother gave me birth. I honor the male in all things but marriage. Yes, with all my heart, I am my father's child. I cannot set more store by the woman's death. And then she acquits him. So basically, she could not care less that Orestes killed his mother, because in Athena's eyes, killing the patriarch of the family is worse than rape, forced marriage, or killing female family members. So despite being a female warrior deity, she was not very protective towards women. So we've looked at some of the most famous depictions of warrior women in Greek myth, but how did that translate to our own culture pre-Wonder Woman? By the 1920s, the term Amazon had come to be a negative signifier in Europe and in America. It was used to label self-sufficient, strong women as bad-tempered and domineering. There's a 1932 Broadway play called The Warrior's Husband. It's based on a 1924 play. It's later turned into a movie in 1933, and turned into a play again in 1942 under the title By Jupiter. So this was very successful, y'all. This is a retelling of the Antiope and Theseus myths. Katharine Hepburn played Antiope in kind of her breakout role. This play is satirizing the idea of Amazons and their independence. The play ends with the Greek men taking over the women and, like, yay, justice is restored. Things are in balance now. So what I'm saying is that our culture's treatment of Amazons pretty much continued what the Greeks had done before us, until Wonder Woman. So 1941, Wonder Woman comes on the scene. Within 2 years, she was featured in 4 different comics. A year after that, she had her own comic strip. Very successful, okay? Before we go any further, I just want to acknowledge that Marston had some very interesting ideas about gender that were very progressive for their time, but very problematic, okay? Marston specifically intended Wonder Woman to be psychological propaganda, and to accomplish this goal, he made some pretty major deviations to the Amazon myth, aside from the major stuff like invisible planes and giant space kangaroos. I love me some kangas. Marston said, "It seems to me from a psychological angle that the comics the worst offense was their blood-curdling masculinity. So the biggest changes he made was to make the Amazons an active force for peace, like Matt talked about, okay? He turned their homeland into an isolationist paradise. They were still fierce warriors. I mean, they literally shot each other with live ammunition for fun. But at their core, they were peaceful. This was a big change from the myth wherein they once took over half of Greece until the brave Athens, to conquered them. So Athens and Aphrodite were their patron goddesses, and again, this is a big change from them being the literal daughters of Ares, and then, of course, Ares was set up as their arch nemesis, again, as Matt's paper discussed. Kind of arguably the biggest change that Marston made was to make them the protagonist, okay? This is one of the ways that he kind of started reappropriating the idea of the Amazons, right? Greek myths, Amazons were always a challenge or an obstacle for male heroes. In Wonder Woman, the Amazons are the heroes. They're their own character. They're their own people. Okay. This point's kind of obvious since, again, it's about Wonder Woman. But let's look at a couple of the examples involving Greek heroes. So we have a very radically different retelling of Hercules' ninth labor. Instead of obtaining the war belt of Ares, he's trying to get Hippolyta's belt of Aphrodite, again, because love is better than war. So instead of arriving on the shores and saying, hey, can I have that belt? He just shows up and attacks. And Hippolyta just beats the crap out of him. So he says, okay, I'm going to have to rethink this. So he comes up with the plan, quote, I will make love to her and steal the magic girdle. Again, tying that sexual and military conquest together. After giving her wine, he tricks her and takes her belt and imprisons her, okay? But again, this is a Wonder Woman comic. So, type a woman in a Wonder Woman comic, you don't want to do that because she's going to beat your ass. So Hippolyta does. Empowered by love, she breaks free, takes back her belt that you can see in her hand, and then literally beats him with the chain that he had used to tie her up, okay? There's another story that kind of Amazon revenge story. Wonder Woman once goes back in time because comics, finds Achilles leading a Greek army to punish the Amazons for siding with the Trojans, like we talked about before. So Achilles is leading that. So Wonder Woman allows herself to be captured so she can talk to Achilles. Immediately breaks free, grabs his sword, and just kind of beats him with the hilt of it. Then gives it back to him and says, hey, you want to fight? And then just absolutely humiliates him. And then leads all the Amazons to just massacre all of his Greek men. Okay? So again, it's kind of a way of showing those warrior women having a chance of, I say getting back at, but overcoming the men that had mistreated them in the Greek myths, okay? I also mentioned Athena. Athena is very, very, very different in Wonder Woman, okay? In Wonder Woman, they kind of downplay her. She's the goddess of wisdom and peace. So this part of one of those text walls Matt mentioned, I'm going to read a little bit of it about Athena. Although she carries sword and spear to protect mortals from the evils of ignorance, she offered peace as her greatest gift to mankind. Her symbol was the olive branch, representing peace and plenty. There's a lot to unpack here. First of all, I don't know how you defeat ignorance with a sword, but okay. This was a way to kind of downplay her role as a warrior, try to explain it away. Her association with the olive branch, that is from myth. It was not for peace. She, of course, is the patron deity of Athens, and their major export was olive oil. This was a plant that was tended to by men and sold by men. So it ties her in with masculine modes of commerce and production. Marston's kind of bending the rules here a little bit, trying to say that she stood for peace, okay? They also tried to downplay the war aspect and tried to play up the wisdom aspect. So Athena gave the Amazons the magic sphere, which was really a big flat disc, that let them see everything that happened and would happen. So it's a gift of unlimited knowledge, right? So in addition to that, she also taught Hippolyta how to make a human form, which of course then Aphrodite made into Wonder Woman. So this ties her into kind of more of a caring, somewhat nurturing mother type deity, at least in the fact that she helped in this creation of a life. Again, a big change from how she was treated in myth. So, kind of in conclusion, so we talked about the Amazons, the real Amazons. We talked about how they were treated in myth. We talked about some of the changes that Wonder Woman's creators made to those myths. But it takes a little bit more than that for successful reappropriation. You may have noticed earlier when I defined the term, I said that the original target of the derogation, or the oppressed group, in this case women, had to be the ones to consciously reappropriate a term. You might have also noticed that neither of Wonder Woman's creators were women. Although Marston did get extensive input for Wonder Woman from both his wife, his girlfriend, and his female assistant, who wrote a bunch of the comics and didn't have her name on it. H.G. Peter also used women to help him draw the comics and did not credit them. But what these men did manage to do is they managed to shift the public perceptions of the Amazons. And they kind of laid the groundwork for the Amazons to be fully reappropriated in the 1970s with her mass adoption by the feminist movement and women in general. So while it turns out that Marston and Peter's versions of the Amazon was pretty far removed from the real Amazons, the Scythian people, Wonder Woman was definitely more in the spirit of Scythian equality than other depictions of Amazons that came before, and it helped to reshape the idea of strong, independent warrior women in popular culture. Thank you.
Thanks again, both Dan and Matt. Very much appreciated. We have time for a couple of questions from the audience, so let's go ahead. And I saw your hand first.
Hi, I really liked what you were talking about with the reappropriation of Wonder Woman. Can you, either of you, comment on how you think that this reappropriation effort might be undercut by the fact that now in the comics she's the daughter of Zeus?
So, can you hear me okay?
No. Here, we're just going to move this down the line as we're
here. Okay.
I have a whole lot of problems with the new 52 Wonder Woman. Some of you might have caught me on the Wonder Woman panel last year, which was still during the run. I had so much faith. I saw they were going somewhere, and then they just went, and went off in the opposite direction. I really thought all those threads were going to come together, and I gave them. It's hard talking about sequential media when it's not finished. So I really defended that book. Kind of regret some of it. Honestly, the Zeus bit doesn't bother me quite as much, and I'll tell you why. Every real-life feminist I know has a biological father. And I think, to quote Grant Morrison, her origins just kind of make her creepy and unrelatable. The idea of coming from clay. Wonder Woman in the Golden Age was... She wasn't super strong. In the Golden Age comics, any woman could do that. And they did. She actually rehabilitated some of her villains, including her arch nemesis, the Baroness, the Nazi agent. And after Amazon training, they were all deflecting bullets and just doing everything that Wonder Woman could do. She wasn't that special. I mean, she was special, but she wasn't that special. So kind of the idea that, like, all women can be this, if you're made out of clay and empowered by the goddesses, is a little bit strange to me. I think that in making her Zeus's child, they've elevated her from just a warrior to a literal goddess, in the same vein as all the other Greek male heroes. You know, so Perseus, Thespian, all these people have that Zeus lineage, Hercules. So I see it as elevating her to that status and making her fully a goddess or a demigoddess. The other thing I actually really like about the relationship, about Zeus being her father, is Hippolyta and Zeus's relationship prior to that, it was very much they met as equals. They fought, and then they didn't fight. several times, like that, like there's this really beautiful couple pages towards the beginning of the run of them meeting as equals and then supporting each other while having sex. That I think is a really nice way of kind of removing some of the problematic submission type elements of the early Wonder Woman, but still kind of have that literally men and women supporting each other, coming together as equals. And that means Wonder Woman's mom can go toe-to-toe with Zeus. You know, I see it as like an elevating of the Amazons to the level of godhood, but at the same time, I can see the criticism.
And that's one of the only positive changes to the Amazons in the new comics.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Any other?
Wonder Woman wasn't the first female superhero, but she was the first one to really stand out. Why do you think that was?
I mean, that's a good question. I think my view is that it actually was Marston's ability to create a different kind of story, right, which was not just about these super bullies, right, which, I mean, you look at 30s Superman and Batman, and they're just thugs, right, they're killers, they're just, I mean, they sometimes have a good social mission, sometimes not so clear, but they are ruthless, they're not very nice people, nothing very nice, you know, they're not good role models. That gets better over time. But Wonder Woman is a really positive figure. You know, she doesn't kill people. She displays this kind of, positive relationships. Even with the villains, they are rehabilitated. There's this whole sisterhood between the Amazons, between Wonder Woman and the Holiday College girls. So I think that it was Marston hit on a portrayal of a really different and interesting and positive, for the most part, character. That's my view.
Yeah, I have an optimistic and a pessimistic answer to this. The optimistic one is, yeah, what Matt said. All these other, as much as I love Golden Age Superman, but at the end of the day, he was written by a couple high school kids. A lot of the comics at the time were written by young people. Not to say young people can't be creative or amazing, but that's just the fact of the matter. They're not quite as experienced. Marston and Peters were established people with careers. Their comics are more complicated and really a little bit more ahead of their time because of that complexity, because they were able to bring more to the table, because they had more experience. So I think that coupled with consciously trying to say, I want to appeal to boys and girls, which is what Marston did, he did that. The pessimistic answer is that there were a ton of amazing female superheroes, and then the Comic Code Authority came out, and women couldn't be protagonists anymore, and they all died out except Wonder Woman, who turned into whose comic turned into a romance comic and was horrible for over 2 decades. She survived when everybody else didn't, because partially dumb luck and partially because of a legal agreement with the Marston family that they had to keep publishing Wonder Woman or else the rights would revert back, so they continued to publish Wonder Woman, even though they were not good stories, they weren't selling well, they weren't critically acclaimed. After Marston's death, this was like in the 50s and the 60s, so she just kind of rode out the storm and was kind of the last woman left standing. I would say it's kind of a combination of both of those.
We've got time for one more question. You there in the back.
The Comics Authority said you couldn't have female protagonists. What was that about?
So the Comic Code Authority had very, very strict ideas of what was appropriate. People in authority could never be corrupt. Violence could only be used as a punishment on bad guys. You could never have a corrupt or incompetent official. And women were supposed to be women, quote unquote. In the 40s, we had Rosie the Riveter, and then all the men came back from war, and then they were expected to be like, you know, Leave It to Beaver, like housewives. So the Comics Code Authority actually discouraged women from being protagonists and being as strong as men. There's actually, I have a snippet somewhere of the, let me read this to you. This is a bit from the DC editorial policy of 1950. For the 1950s, and it said the inclusion, again, this is DC editorial, not the Comic Code, but this was to be in compliance with the Comic Code. The inclusion of females in stories is especially discouraged. Women, when used in plot structure, should be secondary in importance. So that's the comics of the 1950s and into the 60s. So we had Wonder Woman was suddenly being fought over by Steve Trevor, Birdman and Merman, and sometimes an amoeba creature. And she was kind of cast as this like Lonely Hearts newspaper columnist. She completely lost her edge. The war ended, and then shortly after Marston died, and then a new guy came in and wrote for like 2 decades, and it's some of the worst, like most sexist, misogynist stuff I've ever read. One of the famous ones is, have you ever seen the cover of her marriage to Mr. Monster? It's this big monster guy. The story is basically that this monster moves next door to Paradise Island, and he hates all the women and he keeps attacking him, and Wonder Woman decides, if I just love him enough and I just marry him, I can change him. And then he gets mad and kind of like leaves her at the altar, so she decides at the end of the story that she'll cook him something, because a way to a man's heart is to cook him something, and then this will allow her to love him and change him. And again, he's literally abusive, like he attacks the Amazons. So yeah, check out Wonder Woman in the 40s, just skip over the 50s and 60s, and most of all Silver Age stories, you know, you think of good Silver Age stories, you think of Batman and Superman, all the craziness there, you don't think of female characters, because Wonder Woman was it, and it was bad.
Unfortunately, we are over time right now, but I want to give a big round of applause again to Matt and Dan.